We left off looking at the third step. And we were looking at how most of the troubles which have occurred in my life is a direct result of me, based on my self-centeredness and my delusion that, if only I could manage well and if only people would do as I wish, everything would be well. And to wake up one day and realize that everything that happened to me is a direct result of me. It's just like the ripple effect with the lake. Picture a mirrored lake, and if you skip a stone on it, it creates a ripple. Only, in my deluded mind, I thought they were ripples, but in reality, they were tidal waves, and I was destroying everybody and everything I came in contact with. Reversing that, thinking that it was them and not me. And so that's the kind of behavior that I practiced, and that's the kind of behavior that I brought to alcohol, and that's the kind of behavior that I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I needed a behavior overhaul. And so where I got to start to experience some of my self-will, my self-centeredness, and to really see it for what it was, is by starting to address the third step. And over time, the third step has taken on a new meaning. And it continues to change. Have you ever noticed that? Those of you who've been around for a while, you read this book, and all of a sudden it's reading differently. And it's like someone went in there and changed it. What's going on here? It reads different. And I think what happens is I continue to awaken, and as I continue to see things differently, then this book just kind of seems to adapt for me. I think one of the biggest mistakes I made when I got here was I tried to adapt this book to me, and it didn't take, for obvious reasons, because of my selfishness. What I learned I needed to do was adapt to the book and just do these simple little basics. And a rule of thumb for me today is, the basics never change, and they don't. But I do, as I continue to practice and incorporate those basics in my life. And so selfishness and self-centeredness, that's the root of my trouble. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, 100 forms of self-delusion, 100 forms of self-seeking, 100 forms of self-pity, and I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. And I wonder why. I have all these delusions, all these forms of delusions and self-centeredness and fears and self-pity in my life, all based on self. And I don't see anyone or anything other than me. I just can't understand why I can't live in harmony with you, because I'm all about me, and I don't see it. So sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we've made decisions based on self, which later place us in a position to be hurt. Ever do that? Just provoke people just by your presence? Isn't that amazing? Now, this happened to me a couple of years ago. I was driving on the freeway. And, I'm not proud of this, but one of my suppliers, here was the justification. He gave me a bunch of materials, which I never paid for. And then he sold the business. And so I figured, well, he made money off business. He don't need my contribution. And, and justified not paying. And I had to inventory that and look at the truth. And the truth was, we were good friends, and he trusted me enough where I didn't even have to fill out an application. He just gave me credit. Isn't that amazing? And the kind of ego I have, it's like, okay, there were a couple damaged pieces of sheetrock, and I wasn't too happy with the delivery. Well, therefore, I'm not going to pay for it. And yet the guy went out on a limb for me and trusted me and says, just as long as you pay your bill. So seemingly without provocation, here I'm driving down the freeway a couple of years ago, and this car just about run me off the road. I'm going, what's up? And the guy rolls down his window and says, you owe me money. And, and I go, I didn't even recognize him at first. But then I go, oh, this is great. Here's another one to add to the financial amends list. And when they pop up like that, you can't ignore them. got to do something about it. So, you know, and what an amazing deal, you know. I didn't have to do anything. I just had to be present. And I created a, you know, I provoked this person. And what was so strange, because of my self-centeredness, didn't even recognize the person at first. And had done business with him for over 10 years. Didn't even recognize him. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Oh, I didn't like to, I didn't like to see that when I first got here. But you know, what an amazing truth that is. Thank God. Thank God my troubles are of my own making. If my troubles were of your making, or her making, or their making, you, her, or them would have to change in order for me to get well. You can stay sick. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You don't have to change. One of the discoveries that I made was that if I have a disturbance within me, it's got nothing to do with you. It's got something to do with me. There's something within me that needs to be addressed. And so my troubles are on my own making. I am the problem maker, not the problem solver. And, you know, and I've always had that uncanny ability to create a mess and then somehow blame you for what happened to me. And not even blink. Say, oh yeah, it's all your fault. How can you do this to me? And yet, I'm the one who did it to me. No one did it to me. I did it to myself. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. Extreme. Another place they say, I'm strangely insane when I'm drinking. Never mild, never mellow. You know, you do any charity work when you were belligerent drunk? You go help little old ladies across the street, you do wonderful acts, wake up in the morning after a five-day blackout and go, dang, I made the front page of the paper. I've really been busy and I've been brilliant. Under out of me. Always created damage. And then what was really an eye-opener for me is I created just as much damage sober as I did drunk. And I was unaware of it because I was caught up in self. So you remove alcohol from me, and what replaces the bottle? Me. Me and my interests and my self-centered fear and my self-pity. And all the things you've done to me to make me the way I am, it's all because of you. And I have nothing to do with it. And then to be taught that, no, you have everything to do with it, and you need to be responsible and own it. Because if you don't own it, it's going to continue to own you. And that's what it did for a long time. It kept me in the bondage of self. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. And so then they're going to map out a plan for me to face and be rid of the things that block me from the power of God. And they're all manifestations of self. I must, or it's going to kill me. That's a pretty powerful statement. Tells me that resentment is the number one offender. It's a spiritual malady that destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Don't kill them, it destroys them. It creates a canker, it creates a separation. But my selfishness will kill me. My selfishness will create a pride within me that I won't be willing to reach out for any help. I won't follow any directions from anyone. I'll be so wrapped up in myself that I'll kill myself, trying to prove that I'm not like you. And so I must be rid of my selfishness. And here's the silliness of my alcoholism, and this is the extreme I can take it to. And you know, there's a little poem I like. There once was a man named Jay who was always defending his right of way. He was right, dead right, as he sped along, but he's just as dead as if he were wrong. So where are we now? Doesn't matter. I do not have to prove that I'm right. I don't have to go to those lengths anymore of trying to prove anything. Because all I was doing, and was totally unaware of it, was I was killing myself to live and didn't even know it. And like the good drunk I am, I'm always the last one to find out. It's glaringly apparent to everybody else. They see it. And they can be telling me that for years, and I still don't get it. Until one day something snaps. I don't know what it is, but something happens. And then that all changes. Many of us have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would like to. And I shared earlier about some of my religious and spiritual convictions and moral convictions and philosophies. It wasn't enough to create that change. It wasn't enough to keep me sober. And I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to create damage to anyone or anything anymore. And yet I didn't know anything else to do. I just did what I always had done. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. So I can bring my memories and experiences to this, and I could spend all afternoon sharing with you my failures in trying to do this, trying to wish this thing away that I didn't know I had. And in vain, trying to figure it out, and it would always slap me in the face and knock me down again, and I didn't know. I didn't know how to deal with this deal because I was unaware of the problem. And you know, and as we learned in the second step, I only have one problem. Out of that problem come a lot of problems, but there's only one. And my problem is lack of power. And I have to find a power greater than myself which is going to take care of my problem, not my problems. So the power is going to replace my powerlessness. Show me how to live, because I don't know how. So I need to surrender to power. This is the how and why of it. First of all, I had to quit playing God. I remember first time reading that going, what are they talking about? I never tried to play God. And then as I started inventorying my life, that's all I did. And isn't that what we can still do today? Anyone ever play God in meetings? When people aren't saying or doing what you think they ought to do? Isn't that a manifestation trying to play God? And you know, and then I came to a realization to realize that, yeah, although I have a belief system and I have a faith and trust in God, I still have an agnostic side. And as it doesn't matter how spiritual I become and how much I trust and rely on God, I'm still an agnostic. And all that means to me is there are still times in my life that I do not trust God. I doubt that power and direction, and then I decided to do it my way one more time and find out the hard way that it was a bad idea. And you know, and I can resist that change and do silly little things. And today, you know, it's the twigs that trip me and not the trees, because I've dealt with a lot of that major stuff. Here's a twig that made me sicker than sick just recently. One of my good friends lives up above me in this apartment. And he says, you know, it's not good that you don't have TV. Here, let me run a cable to you. I couldn't live with that. Why? Because it's selfish and it's dishonest. Label it whatever you want is stealing. And I was conscious of that. And here's the kind of alcoholic mind I have. Being conscious of it and knowing that it's wrong, I have to deal with it. But I didn't. I made excuses. And I talked to my friend and I says, I think we need to disconnect this cable. I can't be doing this. And he says, it's all right. They're a bunch of crooks anyway. They rip people off. So I didn't act on it. I didn't do anything. You know, I suffered the consequences. For 5 days, I was physically sick. I had no energy levels. I didn't know what was going on with me. And I realized what was going on. I had a prompting and an inclination, and I didn't act on it. I put that aside and went about my own agenda, and I suffered the consequences. So I went to my friend and says, "We've got to disconnect this. I cannot live with this anymore." And as soon as it's disconnected, I slept like a baby. My conscience was clear. And then a couple more jobs showed up, and I was able to take care of some unfinished business. But just something that simple. And, you know, and I learned a great lesson in that, because the spiritual path is demanding. It demands that I'm honest. It demands that I practice honesty. And, you know, and just a simple little thing. And it might not have fazed 90% of the people in the world, but it fazed me, man. It fazed me. And it had such an impact on me that I had to take some action and face and be rid of it. And, you know, and I was the one who created the problem. Now, in hindsight, having had that experience, knowing right from the gate that it was selfish and dishonest, ever in a situation like that, now I've learned to say no and say, "No, I can't do that. That's not honest. That's selfish, and I can't afford what comes along with that. It's not free for me. It's too high a price to pay." So I got to quit playing God. It didn't work. And next in this drama called life, and what I've discovered, most of the drama in my life I created, there's really not that much drama. We decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. So now I have a director, and he's the principal. So I'm going to live by spiritual principles in my life. He's my director, he's my protector, and he's the principle by which I live and give. And I'm his agent. So in other words, he will demonstrate through me what he can do. I don't do it. He does it through me, providing I face and be rid of the things that block me so that I can be about his business, so that I can fit myself to be a maximum service to God and those about me. He is the Father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. So we went from a foundation, now we're building a house, if you will. We're building an arch through which we shall walk free. And we'll all be free men. And the keystone is the key to the whole deal. And if you remove a keystone from an archway, what happens? It crumbles. Any brick mason knows that. That's the thing that holds the whole thing together. So the keystone of my recovery, the keystone of this spiritual path, is my relationship with God. If that is not in place, none of this other stuff is going to work. It doesn't matter how much inventory I write. It doesn't matter how many times I read this book. It doesn't matter how many people I work with. If I do not have an intact, in place archway and have the keystone running the deal, this isn't going to work for me, because my self-will will rear its ugly head once again, and I'll be doing it my way. And it says, when we sincerely took such a position, so we take the position, we're willingly and wantingly have that desire to do it this way. Not my way, but God's way. We have a new employer, and being all powerful, he provides what we need if we keep close to him and perform his work well. So in other words, it becomes time for me to be about his business. So my business is to be about his business, and his business is to take care of me. My life is no longer any of my business. However, the conduct of my life is, and I'm responsible for what I do and how I act and how I react and how I treat others. Staying sober isn't enough. I have to take this stuff and apply it in all my affairs. So that means that the spiritual principle isn't just involved in these rooms, but I have to do that stuff on a daily basis. I have to demonstrate it in my home, at work, and in all affairs with other people. And it took a long time for me to learn this simple one, paying bills on time is a spiritual principle. It's a thing I have to do. I didn't think that I had to pay bills for the longest time. You know, they're big corporations. That was always my justification. They don't need my money. They don't want my money. They want their money. I'm the one who made the deal with them, and I need to be responsible and follow through. And for a long time, I didn't do that. With or without alcohol, it didn't make a difference because I'm self-centered in nature. So I always put me before the responsible thing to do. You know, a budget, what's that? That was something that I learned through the inventory process. Inventory in and of itself isn't enough. About 5 or 6 inventories, budget came up. It's something that I needed to address and do, and I never did it. So guess what happened? I kept on coming back. So it wasn't until I took action and amended that and got a financial advisor and got someone to put me on a budget and give me directions and show me how to do that that the changes started to take place. But I needed to do it. I had to put forth the incentive and take the action. Thinking about it wasn't enough for me. Writing it down and sharing it with God and another human being wasn't enough for me. I had to take action. I had to take it further. I had to do something. So established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. So I get to be a contributor once I make this surrender. I get to give back. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, we became conscious of His presence. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Then we're at the third step. And I'm sure most of us are familiar with it. And it's interesting because there's no amen at the end of it for a good reason. And it says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. There's no amen. I have commenced a spiritual activity. I'm in a safe and a protected place. Now it's time to move on into inventory and to face and be rid of those things that block me from the power of God. And so that's why there isn't an amen. The amen doesn't show up until the seventh step. Because now I need to start trusting. One of the things I do with those I sponsor, when they're in an inventory and we make that commitment and they start a four-step, they're to pray this prayer every day to be reminded that they need to be rid of the bondage of self and that they need help to face and be rid of those things that block them. Further on, as we get into the inventory, the first direction I'm given in the resentment inventory, and the way I was taught to do this, everything is outlined in this book, and there's charts, and there's other things out there, and there's some really good incentives, and there's a bunch of different ways to do inventory. But one of the ways that I have found most effective was the way that I was taken through in the book. And the first thing, the first direction I'm given, it says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. So I write down my resentments. It says we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. That's it. That's my first direction. One of the things I was taught with this book is when you're, as you're going through this process, when you come to a direction, stop and do it and go no further. So there's my first direction. Boom, if I were sponsoring you, we'd close the book and you'd go home and you'd start praying and asking God to show you where you've been angry and who you're angry at. All the institutions, top of the list for me was IRS for institutions, banks, lending institutions, the judicial system, jails, so on and so forth. people. It was amazing. I mean, I had a lot of anger when I got here. In my fourth year, I decided to really, really put this to the test. And, you know, and not that I ran all these through the process, because it wasn't necessary. A lot of them had already been dealt with. But over a three-day period, I decided to try to do it this way and see if it would make a difference. And I kept on getting premonitions, and names kept on popping up. And in a three-day period, I wrote down 357 names. Now, you know, I took like 56 or 57 through the entire process. But that exercise was for me. It wasn't necessary for me to share each and every one of those with a sponsor. But what it was necessary was for me to establish and see, to see that cycle, to see how I had developed this behavioral pattern which was so self-destructive in my life. And, you know, and I was able to see that it had commenced at a very, very young age. My earliest recollections, right up to date. And nothing had changed. And I believe this is a continuation of inventory, that the majority of the conditioning that I practiced in my life, I developed between the ages of 9 and 15. And so that's been, you know, I'm 46, that's a long time. Those just don't go away overnight. Just simple little things, like it was in my fifth year. I stopped doing something I'd done for years. It was just a natural thing for me to do if I was in a stranger's house and use their bathroom. I'd open the medicine cabinet and see what was in there. I did that for years. Don't do that no more. And, you know, and that's just an example of you know, of how deep-seated this thing is in me. So, you know, so here I have all this conditioning, and then with relationships, it was absolutely disastrous, you know, because of my attitudes that I had, you know, especially towards the opposite sex. So I was able to see those patterns, and over a period of time, see those change as well. So with resentment, that's what I do. First thing is I write the list. Second thing, and so what I do then is I take a name and put it on one piece of paper. That's it. If I have 50 names, I got 50 pieces of paper. Then I go through and I do the second column. And I write why I'm angry on every one. That's all I'm looking at is why I'm angry. Then the third column, I write what it affects. What's been affected? What's the cause here? I know why I'm angry. Example, my mother. I was angry at her. One of my resentments was I felt like she abandoned me and she favored my father. What did it affect? It affected my relationships, especially with women. It affected trust. And that's it. It's really that simple. I don't need to elaborate and you know and write a history. I just want to get right to the point. What did it affect? It affected my relationships, my self-esteem, my sex relationships. It affected trust. That's it. And then it's the fourth column where the freedom is. And it's the one I don't want to look at. It's apparent that, first thing apparent, was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. That's where most of us got. Yeah, they were wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. Usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. So I'm going to look at this at an entirely different angle. So I turn back to this list. It tells me that this is fatal if I don't deal with it, that the insanity will return and I'll probably drink again. So I need to really be serious about this. For me, this is life and death. It's not a laughing matter. You stick around long enough, you'll go to enough funerals. You'll see that most people who come here, well-intentioned people, people way better than me who deserve this, don't get it. Why? I don't know. But they don't, and we go to their funerals. So I turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future, We were prepared to look for it, not at it. That's a big key. What am I?
Truth.
I'm looking for my truth. I'm prepared to look for it at an entirely different angle. So I disregard everything that I think I know about this resentment, and I'm willing to walk in an entirely different angle and look at this from a different viewpoint. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. So they had a great hold on me, great control over my life. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. I was taught, if you were there, it was fancied. Makes sense to me, because I wasn't playing with a full deck to begin with. So of course I created it, concocted it, and elevated it, and made it more than what it was. So fancied or real, that resentment actually has power to kill me. Because it keeps me separated from God, and it keeps me separated from you. How can we escape? We saw these resentments must be mastered, but how? We couldn't wish them away any more than alcohol. So then they lay out for me a course of action, and this is our course. We realized the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. And so here's the resentment prayer. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we cheerfully grant a sick friend. Not a sick person, a sick friend. Consider some of your close friends, if they were sick, what would you do for them? Anything and everything you could to make them feel comfortable. That's how I'm to view those who I have a resentment towards, those who have hurt me. My mother remarried when I was young. I was probably 8 years old, and my stepdad was one of us. And he was a violent alcoholic, and in my early teen years, I went through a lot of beatings. I experienced a lot of violence. I had my head put through a wall on Christmas Day. I was sexually abused, and I had a lot of hate towards that man. And I got a freedom in here that I'd never seen before when I started to look at it at an entirely different angle. And perhaps he was sick just like me. And one of the truths I discovered is a continuation of inventory, and an inventory I did on him a couple of years ago. And here was an amazing experience I had with this. For a long time, I was so wrapped up in losing a sister and in the alienation of my family, I stayed away from him for years, probably about 15, 16 years. Didn't really have a whole lot to do with him. Just kind of like little hit and runs here and there. And I had a lot of anger and a lot of hate towards what he'd done to me. And as a result of following the inventory process and answering these seven questions we're going to look at, I saw the truth. And the truth is, given the same situation, being in the same circumstances, I could have acted just as badly as he did. I could have done everything that he done. Not that I would mean to do that to anyone else, not that I have, but given the same circumstances, I am very capable of doing exactly what he did. And so I got to see some of the things in his own life. He's a black sheep in his family. He is a raging alcoholic. He had no control over things. And the one thing that I didn't realize until I'd done several inventories on him and dealt with several resentments, I wasn't the only one who lost someone. I lost a baby sister. He lost a daughter, and he didn't know how to deal with it. And he never dealt with it. And although he got sober in 87 and he died last year, and here's the sad thing for us, and it's a great example for me that separation from alcohol is not enough for an alcoholic like me. He ground away every decent thing in his life. My mom and sister were glad when they got the call that he was dead. Isn't that sad? He was dead for 4 months before they found his body. And he hadn't had a drink since 1987. And that's a sad way to go. But what I realize is everything that happened to him, all the loneliness, all the despair, everything that happened to him could happen to me too. And I got free. And I was able to forgive him. Because given the same circumstances, I could have done everything that he did. And so here's the questions that I get to ask myself. And here I think is the key to my future. And it's the most important part of the resentment inventory. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. Here's my first question. Where have I been selfish? So I answer that question in a sentence. And the second one. Where have I been dishonest? And the third one, where have I been self-seeking? Fourth one, where have I been frightened? Though a situation had not entirely been my fault, I tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. How often have we heard we look for our part in inventory? That's not what the book says. I disregard the other person entirely. It's not their inventory. It's mine. It's my inventory. I need to disregard them entirely. So my fifth question is, where am I at fault? And the fault is the action. What's the action that created this? And my action in my relationship with my father was, I put forth no effort being in recovery, although I did a 10-page closure about six, seven years ago, I never followed through. I never tried to heal. I never tried to do anything to make anything right. I just blamed him for everything that happened. Where am I to blame? What's my thinking? So the fault is the action. Blame is the thinking. The inventory is ours, not the other's man, not the other man's. When we see our faults, so when I see my actions and where I've been thinking wrong, I list them. I place them before me in black and white. I admit my wrongs honestly. So where am I wrong? And I admit them. And this is where my amends list comes from. I'm willing to set these matters straight. Then they go on in the second inventory about fear. Says it's an evil and a corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. So it was a driving force in my life. We think fear ought to be classed with stealing. Now this book was written during the Depression. Stealing was a major offense. It was right next to murder. That's how important this is. It's serious business. Creates a lot of trouble. Most of the things I'm afraid of never happened. And the ones that did happen so fast I miss them anyway. And yet, that's where I live. I create these fears. Just, it's amazing, isn't it? And sometimes, you know, when I'm working with new people, they put it in perspective for me. And, you know, and living in Ogden, we have a big chunk of the Wasatch Front right there, and I'll pick up a little rock and say, what's this? I'll say, it's a stone. They come with all the drama, you know. This is going on. And, you know, and I says, what's this? It's a stone. I says, what's this? Well, that's the mountains. I says, that's what you're doing with that. And isn't that what I do? I take this little pebble of a problem, and I create a mountain of trouble out of it. When in reality, none of those things ever happened, but it sure happened in here, and it seemed real. And so I learn how to get rid of that fear, and the way that we get to get rid of that fear is by just being in the moment. And you know, and there was some fear for me coming here to do this deal this weekend, because it was easy for me to start projecting things. I had no idea what was going to happen. And I've done this long enough to realize all I have to do is just be right here, right now, and be in the moment, and it'd be okay. And whatever was going to happen was going to happen. Because nothing happens in God's world by accident. There's a reason and a purpose for everything. So we review our fears thoroughly and we put them on paper even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Sure. Self-reliance always failed us. It was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. And some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Kind of alcoholic I am. I'm either in one side of the spectrum or the other. Either I have so much fear going on within me, I'm so afraid of you, I'll go so deep within myself you're not going to reach me. Or I'm going to be so cocky, I'm going to do things to try to push you away because I'm afraid you'll find out who I really am. And most of that is self-created. And it's all within me and it's not ever really happened. But it's become my reality. And so then these last two paragraphs is my solution. One of the ways I was taught to do this, the surgical method, is I write the fear, whatever it is. And then why I have the fear. And then I use these two paragraphs as my solution. We think there's a better way. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. So, in other words, whatever you have in mind is better than what I have in mind. It's not my business anymore. But what really is the big difference between faith and trust? I've always liked this analogy. Visualize, if you will, the main event at a circus. And there's this tightrope wire. And there's this guy walks across tightrope wire, probably done 1,000 times. And you're a spectator. You have faith that he's going to walk from point A to point B. He's probably done it 1,000 times. Sure enough, he does. Then he grabs a wheelbarrow. He wants you to get in it. Do you trust? Are you willing to jump in the wheelbarrow, go through the turbulences of life, and no matter what happens in your life, trust God? That's what they're asking me to do here. Am I going to trust? And what I've learned through the process is I continue to learn how to trust and rely upon God. Guess what happens to me? I become trustworthy. People start to trust me. As I rely on God, I become reliable. As I depend upon God, I become dependable. And I become responsible. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is a way of strength. So my weakness does become my strength. Because without my Creator, I have no being. Something allows me to take every breath in every day. You take that away and I have no life in me. Something allows that to happen. It's not me and it's not you. Something allows that to happen. And that's that power. And a great promise in the fear inventory is just as to the extent that we do as we think He would have us, humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. So I no longer have to have that calamity and all that chaos and confusion in my mind. I can have serenity. I can have clarity of thought. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. Not what I can do, but He can do. He does it. I just get to show up. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. What would He have me be? He'd have me be helpful. He'd have me be useful. He'd have me be kind. He'd have me be loving. He'd have me be honest. He'd have me be trusting. He'd have me practice good manners. And so that's what I get to do. At once we commenced to outgrow fear. Took a long time to realize all I really have to do is ask Him to remove it. It'll go away. That's how simple it is, and yet I miss it. think we're about running out of time. 10 minutes? Okay, we'll go through the sex and conduct inventory. And this is really quite fast for me to go through these inventories. Because I spend like probably 1 or 2 hours in each one. But there's a lot to it. And you know, and we're just kind of hitting a few things. Now about sex, many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes. One set of voices cry that sex is a loss of our lower nature-based necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. And here's my guideline, sponsorship. We want to stay out of this controversy. Your sex conduct is none of my business. We do not want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct. So I stay out of this controversy. But I have guidelines here. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? So here, neatly tucked in, the sex inventory is a conduct inventory, and I can take this into any area of my life, any conduct, whether it's work, whether it's AA, whatever. Relationships, here's the questions I can ask myself. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where have I been selfish? That's my first question that I answer. Where have I been dishonest or inconsiderate? Who have I hurt as a result of my conduct? Where have I unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where am I at fault? What were the actions in my conduct that created the problem in the first place? And here's the kicker, what should I have done instead? One of the things I really woke up to in a lot of the relationships I was in is water seeks its own level. And I was attracted to victims because for some strange reason I thought I could fix them and change them. And it was always a disaster because they would never act according to my dictates and policy. Imagine that, huh? And so as a result, it was always a mess. And yet I was the one who created that. What should I have done differently? Knowing what I know now and having experienced healthy relationships and the difference between a sick one and a healthy one, I wouldn't have gone there in the first place. And you know, and I brought in to some friends over the years, and one that I had a major obsession for a few years back, and when I seen her and I just talked to her for a minute, I thought, what did I ever see in you? I didn't see it anymore because the change had taken place. I've never had a successful sick relationship, nor do I ever want one. So in this way we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future, for our future sex life and for our future conduct. Because this is my guideline now. Now that I've made that third step commitment, my life isn't any of my business. However, I need to be tracking my conduct. because it's my misconduct that caused me to drink. It's my misconduct that caused me to be resentful, to be filled with fear, and to treat people badly. So I need to address my conduct. We subject each relation to the test, was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. There's a prayer. We remember always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. So whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. And what better way than to ask God for help to grow towards the ideals he has in mind for me? And I'll talk more about that in amends, because I did a lot of damage in that area because of my selfishness. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. So here's another direction for prayer and meditation. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. That goes into any area of my life, any problem, any specific matter. In prayer and meditation, I ask God what I should do. The right answer will come if I want it. And then it goes on to say the same thing again. We earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex becomes troublesome, we throw ourselves harder into helping others. So we work with others, and we get out of self instead of being overindulged in self. And they tell us that if our conduct continues to harm others, we're quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts about our experience. So I cannot carry on in those self-destructive behaviors. I'm going to pay a price. I cannot be harming people anymore. If we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. We've listed and analyzed resentments. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct. And we're willing to straighten out the past if we can. And in this book, you read again and again, faith has done for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you're convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you've already made a decision, an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. And none of us like to look at that. We don't want to face that. But I think that's it for now. For inventory. Thank you.